Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome to Soul to Soul Radio on 101.9. Hi FM, I'm your host, Rabbi Ari Kiven. It's great to be with you here on this wonderful, beautiful afternoon. And today I want to talk with you about the 20th day of the present month, the month of Av, which is the yahrzeit of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson. Of course, the name Schneerson is likely familiar to most of our listeners here on Soul to Soul. As we know, it is the surname of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak was the Rebbe's father. And on this day, the Rebbe would mark his father's yahrzeit, the anniversary of his passing, by saying Kaddish in his memory and leading a tremendous farbrengen, a beautiful gathering during which he would expound on his father's teachings and legacy. And I remember those farbrengens distinctly in my childhood, attending them while I was a little young to appreciate all the insights and teachings that he shared. But certainly the aura, the atmosphere was just one that was palpably joyous and special. All the day camps and overnight camps would come and participate and be present there, and they would sing songs of the Rebbe's father, and the Rebbe was in a very special mood on that day. And so to mark this day, I thought it would be appropriate for me to share with you a little bit about Rabbi Levi Yitzchak and some of his insights and teachings that were unique to him. It's worthwhile to share a little bit about his background. Rabbi Levi was born to the Schneerson dynasty on the 18th of Nisan in 1878. That was 21st of April that year. And he was a great-grandchild of the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe. He and his wife, Rebbe Tzenchana, are most famous for bringing into this world the Rebbe on the 11th of Nisan in 1902. The Rebbe also had two siblings, Rabbi Yisrael Aryeh Leib, who passed away in the 1940s, and his brother Dov Ber, who was murdered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram. In 1909, Rabbi Leibik was called upon to serve as the rabbi in Yekaterinoslav. Today, it's a big city of Dnepropetrovsk. And so the family moved to that city, and Rabbi Leibik would serve as the rabbi in Yekaterinoslav for 32 years, the last 18 of which he served as the city's chief rabbi. Yekaterinoslav was considered the central city of Ukraine for everything related to Judaism. And so Jews from throughout the region would look to Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson for guidance and during those times, during those years. But those years weren't easy years. He served during tumultuous times, a period that spanned First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution, which led to the installation of communism, the Stalinist purges. It was a very difficult, challenging time. In fact, my father, who was born in the 1930s and lived in Russia during the 30s and 40s, related to us sometimes about many of the challenges and obstacles, the difficulties of growing up during the communist regime in Russia, which I'm sure no one here needs to hear from me, which I personally heard from my father, and even more so from my grandmother, who endured and experienced. She was a five-year-old child when the Bolshevik Revolution happened in 1917, and she shared with us many memories of those days. Yet, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, you can imagine how dangerous it was to be religious, even more so dangerous to be a religious leader during those times. But he was determined and fearless in his leadership of the Jewish community during those days. He stood up to the Soviet authorities. He never wavered in his commitment to the Jewish community, as was exemplified not just by him, but by his cousin, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. And of course, that inspiration, no doubt, being the role model, setting the example for his son, who was later to become the Rebbe. The Rebbe shared over the years many memories of his father being the chief rabbi of Yekaterinoslav, which, like I said, was one of the largest cities in Ukraine. I believe it still is. And during those years, the Rebbe once shared how the city was one which I think it supplied a lot of wheat to a large part of Russia. So when it was time to prepare matzah for Pesach, buyers arrived from across the Soviet Union to purchase wheat. When the government nationalized the matzah business, they asked the Rebbe's father to certify the matzah was kosher for Pesach. In fact, the Rebbe's father was the Rav HaMachshir. He's the one who gave the hechsher to the mills and the bakeries before they were nationalized. And so they approached Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson because they knew that the Jewish buyers would only purchase matzah if Rabbi Schneerson would continue to certify its kashrus. And so Rabbi Schneerson replied that he would need to appoint mashkichim, supervisors in order for them to ensure that the wheat that would be used had no contact with water, as is obvious in order for it to be used for matzah. If the authorities could assure him that they would not interfere with any of his supervision, with any of the mashkichim's certification, then he would in fact certify the matzah. But they insisted on a process that would not fit his standards. And so he said, if that was the case, I cannot certify that this would be kosher, because it would be something that would be, you know, it wouldn't be acceptable in my own conscience, is what the Rebbe felt. And so he told the Soviet individuals who came to him that according to the Soviet constitution, it protected the citizens a right to act according to their conscience. And his conscience did not permit him to falsely declare the matzah kosher if it wasn't indeed meeting and fitting his standards. No one could force him to betray his conscience. And so he, in fact, traveled to Moscow, where he met with the head of the state or one of his deputies, and he explained that it's inappropriate for the state to mislead the Jewish community by forcing a rabbi to falsify the matzah was kosher if he wasn't able to actually supervise it as such. And so as a result, instructions were dispatched to all the mills in Ukraine to allow the Rebbe's father supervisors, that they should be able to supervise and inspect in order to ensure that it would be kosher according to the highest standards. Now, you can easily excuse a rabbi for not ensuring that every detail was met with the highest standards. After all, you're talking about messing with the Soviet Union. You know, punishment for sabotage could easily have earned him a 10-year sentence in the Gulag, which in fact, years later, he wound up sadly dying there. But Reb Levick would not be intimidated when Jewish principles were at stake. Never swaying from his Jewish values, Reb Levi Yitzchak Schneerson was willing to lay down his life for the sake of Jews and Judaism, and therefore he did not allow himself to certify that matzah if it wasn't to the highest standard of kashrut. Another occasion, the Soviets organized a rabbinic conference in Kharkiv. Kharkiv today is still a prominent city in Ukraine. In fact, I have cousins who live there and serve as part of the rabbinic team in Kharkiv. And Reb Levi Schneerson was attending that conference. And during his stay, there was a Jew, Rabbi Nachum Goldschmidt, my brother-in-law's grandfather. He was a young man from Yekaterinoslav. In fact, he was a childhood friend of the Rebbe. And he was studying at the Chabad Yeshiva in Kharkiv. So he visited the Rebbe's father. And Rabbi Schneerson told him that the government was pressuring the rabbis to proclaim that there's no religious persecution in the Soviet Union, which everyone knows, in fact, in hindsight, certainly, of what kind of pressure, unbelievable pressure, they had endured. And so Rabbi Schneerson began to murmur quietly, as if he was speaking to himself, should we sign the statement? If we sign, the government might lighten its grip on the Jews, but in return, the rest of the world might stop pressuring the USSR to ease the plight of Russian Jews, thinking that maybe there is indeed no pressure, no persecution there. And he continued to analyze the question. He was enumerating the pros and cons, and it was a true conundrum, because both options could either harm or benefit the Jews. And at one point, he stood up and he spoke resolutely, as if he had just made up his mind. And he said, no, I'm not going to sign it. How could I sign? Even if they threaten my life, I'm not going to sign. And apparently, he just made up his mind. He had been presented with two horrible options, and he decided to go with the truth, even if they would threaten his life. And so later on, they said that in that moment, my brother-in-law's grandfather related that he perceived this inner strength that the Rebbe's father had. No worldly intimidation could dissuade him from doing what was right. That was the moral fortitude and inner resolve of this great person. At a later date, the Rebbe related that indeed his father did not sign that statement, and he turned down the demands of the Soviet Union. And in fact, it wound up benefiting him, and he wound up getting concessions out of them. Right? There are countless stories of Reb Levick's bravery and his courage for the sake of Jews and Judaism. But sadly, though the Jewish community needed that leadership of a moral and spiritual giant, he was imprisoned for his crimes of counter-revolutionary activities, just as the Rebbe's father-in-law, the father of Rebbetzin Chaim Mushka, the previous Rebbe, and sadly, he passed away in that exile. So today, I thought it would be appropriate to share with you maybe some of his scholarly teachings and some of the correspondence that he had with his son and with others that revealed an original mind, a deep insight, and a broad scholarly grasp of so many facets and aspects of Judaism and of Torah. Now, just to understand, because he was quite a Kabbalistic and mystically minded person, we know there are four general methods for of understanding Torah, right? They're called the Pardes. This is an acronym for four words: Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. Let me explain each of them. Pshat is the literal or simple meaning of a text. And although it's often anything but simple, but it refers to the plain meaning of the word. You read a verse of the Torah and you have the Pshat, the very simple meaning of the word. And I'll try to give you an example of that in a moment. Then, of course, you have Drush. What's Drush? Remez. That's the second letter of Pardes, which, by the way, literally means an orchard. You walk into the orchard of Torah, you enjoy all the luscious fruits, all the different aspects and facets of Torah. So Remez is the symbolic. It refers to allusions derived from reading between the lines using tools such as gematria, or the numerical value of letters, or acronyms that are formed by words. That is Remez, and then you got Drush. What's Drush? That's the homiletic or interpretive meanings, interpretations that are not explicitly written in the text, but are deduced and gleaned by great sages. And finally, you have Sod. Sod is the mystery, the secret aspects, like Kabbalah. So that is where you get Kabbalistic teachings to uncover the mystical or esoteric meanings of a text. And so if you think about it, let's think of the word Shema. Yeah, Shema is the most fundamental Jewish prayer we say every day, declaring our belief in one God. So within Shema, you have Shema Yisrael. Now let's just take the Pshat, the very basic, simple meaning of Shema is listen. But if you want to go into the Remez, into the symbolic meaning, Shema is actually an acronym of three words. Se'u Marom Einechem, lift your eyes on high. Then we could go into the drush. The drush is the homiletic, the interpretive meaning. There you get into Shema. In any language, you have to understand, to listen, to pay attention, to focus. Then you have the sod, the deeper mystical, Kabbalistic understanding. And that would be that Shema spells the word Sham or Shem. Sham means over there, pointing to God. God is everywhere. Or Shem, the name of Hashem. So by absorbing the message of Shema, we reveal that the world is not Sham, distant from God, but a reflection of God, God's name, Shem. So this is, again, getting much deeper into it. And if you want to go even deeper into Kabbalah, you have in the name, in the word Shema, it's an elevation of creation to its actual source, the 10 sfirot, the 10 utterances that with which God created the world, that operate in those 7 days, which together 7 times 10 equals 70. Again, you got the ayin, the number 70, which is getting much deeper and more mystical, which wasn't my intention. But the idea, again, is to understand that when you look at each facet of Torah, it's a complete area of study. Each of these areas, Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod, are a whole universe of study. And Rabbi Levi Yitzchak was famously known for weaving seamlessly between them in many of his teachings. And in fact, the Rebbe's primary teacher was his father. And he followed his father's lead in this respect. As you notice, in many of the Rebbe's teachings, he would lecture extensively on Torah topics, weaving seamless connections between the many dimensions of the Torah. And he particularly enjoyed the mystical and the symbolic aspects. He was fascinated by Torah's language. He would delve into the composition, the syntax, the numerology, and mysticism of the Torah's texts and cover untold layers of meaning. He would often uncover and share many of his discoveries, hidden codes, and weaving this tapestries between seemingly disconnected concepts and disjointed text, which I'm going to share some of those ideas with you shortly, because I think it's worthwhile that as we are commemorating his yahrzeit, it's great to actually delve into some of his teachings and enjoy the bold originality and amazing breadth of a scholarship, which we'll get to in a moment when we'll be right back.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to Soul to Soul right here on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm your host, Rabbi Ari Kiven. It's great to be with you here on this wonderful afternoon. And we've been talking about the life and the scholarship of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, the father of the Rebbe. So I have a question to ask you, as I would like to introduce one of his beautiful scholarly ideas, to share with you a little bit of the scope of his teachings. So let me ask you a question. We all know that eliminating a Torah commandment is certainly wrong. But my question is it also wrong to add to the Torah's commandments? What do you think? Yes, no, maybe, it depends. Let me explain. When word got out that the KGB, the old Soviet Union's murderous secret police force, was preparing to arrest Rabbi Schneerson, some of his friends visited him in secret. And Rav Levick shared a teaching that would serve as his departing message. And therefore, I think it's relevant for me to share it with you today. And I'd like to read to you from Yalkut Levi Yitzchak on the Torah, some insights of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson. And he shares as follows. Ha'ois harishana shel ha'Torah hu beis bereishis. What is the first letter of the Torah? We all know it's a beis, as in the word bereishis. What is the last letter of the Torah? It is a lamed from the word Yisrael. Says Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, these two letters we know spells the Hebrew word lev, heart. And if you read it, that's if you read from end to beginning, because the Torah never ends. We go immediately on Simchas Torah. As soon as we finish reading the Torah, as soon as we conclude the book of Devarim, we right away restart from the beginning, from Bereishis. So there you got the word lev, the heart. But if you start from beginning to end, then you got the word bal, Bereshit Beis. Followed, the last letter is a lamed. You got the word bal, which means don't. You might be familiar with that word from davening in Tehillim, Psalm 93, where we say, Avtikon tevel bal timot, or davening every morning, mishpatim bal yedom haleluka. So this, explained Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, means the following. What is this first letter beis, the last letter lamed, that could spell lev, the heart of the Torah? What is the heart of Judaism? And what is bal, don't? What is the significance and the meaning of these two words that are formed by the first and last letter of the Torah? And he says, if you look at these letters, they really share with us a profound insight. And his message was, if you want to serve God with all your lev, with all your heart, then bal, then there's something that you should not do. We read in the parsha last week, the verse says, "Shmartem la'asois," you should be careful to do, "Kasher tziva Hashem alekechem," precisely as Hashem your God instructs you, "Lo sasuru yamin esmol," never deviate, don't turn, don't veer neither to the right nor to the left. So Rav Levick suggested that the first and last letters of the Torah are associated with this verse of the Torah, not to veer right or left. But his idea, his concept is a little bit more mystical, but also quite practical. He says, what if you turn to the right or to the left of these two letters of Beis and Lamed? What letters will you get? So again, the verse says, don't add, don't turn to the right, don't turn to the left. So what happens now if we turn to the right and to the left of Beis and Lamed? What are the letters that you will get? So think of the Hebrew alphabet. If you're driving, think it in your mind. If you are sitting in front of a book, you could just cheat, or I'm sure you know it. The letter to the right of the Lamed is, that's right, a Chaf. And the letter to the right of the Beis is Aleph. Why did I do the Lamed before the Chaf? I don't know. So letter to the right, what does that spell? Aleph and Chaf spells the word Ach. Ach means however. It's exclusionary. Now let's look at the letters to the left of the Beis and the Lamed. The letter to the left of the Beis is a Gimel. The letter to the left of the Lamed is a Mem.
Together, these two spell the word gam, which is inclusionary. It's in addition. Gam means also. So what was his message? If you want to be complete, you want to be a proper Jew, you want to serve God with a complete heart, with your whole lev, all you need to do is remember the secret code of the first and last letters of the Torah. The secret is follow the Torah's rules meticulously. Now, you might infer from the fact that Rabbi Levi chose this lesson as his parting teaching that he intended to assure his community that they would survive without him as their chief rabbi if they simply followed the Torah's instruction not to deviate from it, not right, not left. Don't digress from the teachings of the Torah. Baal, the first and last letter of the Torah, Beis and Lamed, don't turn to the right of meticulous observance. To the right of Beis, to the right of Lamed, lies the word Ach, however, which is an exclusionary clause. It's making exceptions. As we know, the Talmud says, Ach v'rak l'ma'it, that the words Ach and Rak, however and only, are exclusionary. So a person might think, under ordinary circumstances, I would never go to work on Yom Kippur. However, you know, as he explained then, the Soviet Union is a different world, and it's okay, you're living in Russia under the communist regime, so perhaps it's permissible to go to work on Yom Kippur. Remind me to tell you a fascinating story about my grandmother, blessed memory, what she did to avoid work on Yom Kippur, and how that connected to a story with a member of our community who had moved to America just before COVID. And unfortunately, he didn't have the job he was promised. And during COVID, he did all kinds of work in order to survive and to support and sustain his family. And then one day he got an amazing, incredible job offer. The problem was the training was going over Yom Kippur. And he called me as his former rabbi, or should I say, he still considers me his rabbi. And he says, what do I do? And I told him the story about my grandmother who had to get away from work on Yom Kippur in the Soviet Union, which was very dangerous, and she risked her life for it. But ultimately, it was an incredible story. You can read that story. It's published online on ChabadSouthAfrica.org and other places. I told him that story. I said, it will only be to your benefit if you stand tall, proud, and strong about your Judaism. And in fact, you will be respected for it. And he called me back to tell me that his superior was impressed to hear his commitment and was all the more so interested in hiring him for this position. Told him, now that what's going to happen, the training day of Yom Kippur is only going to be something that is a review, a report, and he would be exempted from it, and he can make it up another day. We have to remember, God gave us the laws. We cannot be exclusionary. We cannot create the ifs and buts and howevers. We have to know what is to the right of Baal, of don't, is Ach. Don't digress. Don't deviate. Don't do that. Don't turn to the right and distract yourself from the Torah's rules. Don't make exceptions. And at the same time, the Torah says, the verse we read in last week's parsha said, "Lasasur yamin usmal." Not only not to turn to the right, but also says, don't turn to the left. To the left of Beis Alamed, we said, lies the word gam, which is also. In addition, what does that mean? What does an addition mean? What can I do? You know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but a person thinks to themselves, I love Judaism so much. So gam, I'll also add to the Torah. The Torah tells me, the Torah forbids me from working on Shabbos. You know what I want to be extra from? I won't work on Friday either. And a man once was telling me how religious is grandfather, he said, his Zayda was so from. He didn't only wear a yarmulke, he wore a shekel under his yarmulke. Yeah, he was so religious. He didn't just have two sinks for milchigs and fleishigs. You know, he also had one for treif. I'm just kidding. Yeah, he was telling me how from he was. He said the guy never drank milk because he only wanted not just chalav Yisrael, but chalav kohen. But then he said, you can't drink milk from a cow because the cow is also meat. So you can't have milk that came from meat. And this guy was telling me how religious his grandfather was. He said, you know, it's a mitzvah. We say Tosfos Shabbos to begin Shabbos a little bit earlier. So this man decided he wasn't just going to bring Shabbos a little bit earlier on Friday. He was going to bring Shabbos in on Tuesday. And even though there's an Erev in Joburg, he wouldn't even let his voice carry on Shabbos. You get what I'm saying? The point is that just as it is wrong to eliminate one of God's commandments, it is also wrong to create new restrictions, new commandments in God's name. And this is what the Torah is saying. You shouldn't add and you shouldn't subtract. And of course, we know that there are rabbinical commandments and there are certain personal restrictions or customs. So long as we don't claim that they're forbidden by the Torah, we don't say it in God's name, right? You know, the story all the way back at the beginning of creation, what happens when God tells Eve, Chava, don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And yet, what does she say to her husband? Not even to touch it. And that's what they say to the Nachash, that God forbade them from even touching the Eitz Hadas on pain of death. And when the snake, when the serpent pushed her against the tree and she didn't die, what happened? It ended up disastrous and they were expelled from paradise. So we know that you can add your own fences. In Pirkei Avot, we read at the very beginning, Moshe Kibbutz Har Sinai, we read the whole story, the beginning of the Masara, the tradition of Judaism. And what does it say? That there were three things that the men of the Great Assembly taught. And what were they? First one is have a Masunim Badin to be discerning getting a judgment. Famida Tamidam Harbe, you should establish many students. Asus Yaga Torah, you should make a fence to the Torah. What does it mean to create a fence, a barrier? You want to create preventative measures in your life that you would that would prevent oneself from deterring to deter oneself from violating, from transgressing biblical commandments. But that is a personal enactment, not a restriction in God's name. And that was the message Rabbi Levi Yitzchak was teaching. If you refuse to stray towards to the right, however, excluding from the Torah, or even adding Gam, which is the left two letters of Lev, or Baal, then you know what? You will have Lev. You will serve God with a perfect faith and a complete heart. So the thing is, I mean, on my own, I certainly wouldn't see the link between the two letters, you know, on completely different ends of the Torah, and how turning to the right or turning to the left, you could get a whole fascinating, insightful lesson. Rav Levi Yitzchak Schneerson not only saw the link, but he examined it backwards and forwards and derived a profound teaching about Jewish survival under the oppressive communist Soviet regime where he was living. And that's just but one example of his profound teachings. Let me share with you another one. Another beautiful, fascinating teaching from Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson. And this one's a little bit more complex because it flows seamlessly between the literal, the pshat of the Torah, and the drush, the more, the remez, the more symbolic interpretations, and the drush, the more expounding interpretive element of Torah, and of course, sod, the deep mystical secrets within the Torah, which he was renowned for expounding upon. There was a chamber in the Beit HaMikdash in the Holy Temple, which the high priest would quarantine annually for 7 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And during this time, he would prepare himself mentally and spiritually for the holiest day of the year. What was the name of that room? It was called Lishkas HaEitz, the wooden chamber. Because of its wooden paneling, it got that name, and it's described in Tractate Midos, talks about the wood was plastered over because wood was not permitted to show in the Beis HaMikdash. In Masechet Yom, it explains that the chamber was previously called Lishkas HaBavli, which is Greek for the chamber of, Lishkas Palvati. Palvati means the important officials. And it's possible that it was called Lishkas HaEitz before the sages began to use Greek at the time. So it's also possible that both names were used concurrently, one in Hebrew, that was Lishkas HaEitz, the wooden chamber, and Lishkas Palvati, the Greek name for it. And Rav Levick explains the connection between the two names according to Kabbalah, which we're not going to have time in today's segment to delve into, but it's certainly fascinating and gives you a sampling of the way he looked at things. But in our limited time today, let me just share with you this beautiful insight that he explains. At one point, our sages changed the name, the Lishkas Parhedrin, Parhedrin is the Greek word, which means the assessors. So this name, this room, this chamber seemed to have multiple names. Not only was it called Lishkas Balvati, it was also called the Lishkas Eitz, the wooden chamber, and then they changed the thing to Lishkas Palhedrin. So what is this Lishkas Palhedrin, and that Rabbi Levi Yitzchak explained? What does it mean, the room, the chamber of the assessors? And he explained it refers, based on the Mishnah, that it refers to the tax collectors who are appointed for a one-year term. So why was the name of the room changed based on the tax assessors? Well, let's look in the Gemara. The Gemara says that the high priests that paid to be appointed, unfortunately, in the Second Temple era, there was lots of corruption in the Jewish community, even amongst the Kohanim, the priests who were serving in the Holy Temple. So they would try to bribe their way, cozying up to the tax collectors and getting various concessions in order to have their positions and their influence. So they called it the Palhedrin chamber. And Rashi explains the situation. Yehuda the Maccabee, hero with the story of Hanukkah, he established the Hasmonean royal dynasty, the Hasmonaim. Yehuda and his brothers were very righteous, but unfortunately their descendants, many of them, became corrupted, and they took to auctioning off the office of the high priesthood to the highest bidder at the time. And now this new breed of high priests were not appointed based on their piety and their merit, but for their influence because of their wealth. And what you had was unworthy people who were in this position of high priesthood. I mean, there is something special to consider there, like in the story of Korach. What did they aspire towards? Towards leadership, towards being the Kohen Gadol. And while that's something special, nevertheless, we know that you had the wrong people in this position, especially because we know that if somebody was not of the qualification for that position, then they actually weren't qualified to enter the Holy of Holies, this very special place. And in fact, if they walked in the Yom Kippur, they would immediately die because they had to be replaced each year due to their disqualification for this position. Our sages decided to call the chamber of the unworthy high priest the Lishkas Parhedrin, the room of the chamber of the tax assessor, reminiscent of the tax collectors who were replaced annually as well. So this is something very fascinating. And of course, we have to understand, what is the connection? What is this talking about? What is the link and message of this insight, which we'll get right back to in a moment after these messages.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Welcome back to Soul to Soul, right here on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm your host, Rabbi Ari Kiveman, and we've been talking about the life and legacy of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, the father of the Rebbe. And I was sharing with you some insights about his unique way of understanding and covering the Torah through the Pardes, through the orchard that the Torah is, the Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod, the different dimensions of understanding Torah, from the simple understanding through the deeper homiletic and mystical Kabbalistic appreciation. And I want to share with you this beautiful insight. We were in the middle of a discussion about the chamber in the temple in which the Kohen Gadol would quarantine, would isolate for 7 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur during the time that he would prepare himself mentally and spiritually for the holiest day of the year. And we mentioned that this name, the room where he stayed during that time, had two names. One was Lishkas Eitz, although it had a, which means the wooden chamber, although it had a previous name that they called it, the name that meant a Greek name, the Lishkat Balvati, that was the chamber for important officials. But the other official name it was given was Lishkas Palhedrin, which meant literally the room, the chamber of the assessors, of the tax collectors. Think of a room where the SARS officials might be. And we wondered, what is the significance about this? And the first explanation based on the Talmud was that the Mishnah explained that back then, just as there were these tax collectors and to prevent them from becoming corrupted and taking bribery for favors, they would only have a one-year term for their position. And the Gemara explains likewise that many of the priests in the latter end, towards the end of the Second Temple era, were unfortunately corrupted and weren't deserving of that position of the high priesthood. And therefore, they wouldn't last the year, because once they would come into the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh Yerushim, on the day of Yom Kippur, they suffered the ultimate punishment of immediate death. And because they had to be replaced annually, our sages took to calling the chamber of the room where they prepared themselves, since they were unworthy, the Lishkas Parhedrin, reminiscent of these tax collectors who would be replaced annually as well. But on the face of it, we have two satisfactory explanations for the two names of the high priest chamber, the Lishkas Ha'etz, the wooden chamber, because that room was made out of wood, and the Parhedrin chamber, referring to the unfortunate chapter in our temple's history of the corruption where people would bid for that position of high priesthood to be the Kohen Gadol. However, Rav Levi Yitzchak Schneerson was not satisfied with those explanations, and he probed deeper and shared a more mystical connection, and he uncovered these deep esoteric links between the names and the eras that they represented. And he began by noting that Lishkas Ha'etz is more accurately translated not as the chamber of wood, but rather the tree chamber, because Eitz means a tree. And trees, he explained, represent longevity and durability. And we know that there's a verse in Isaiah that tells us, Kimei Ha'etz Yimei Ami, like the days of a tree are the days of my people, says Hashem. So long as the high priests were righteous and enjoyed longevity, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak explained, then it was called Lishkas Ha'etz, the wooden chamber. But unfortunately, afterwards, when the high priests were not righteous and were not deserving of longevity, and they didn't live long because they would die, no matter how noble and special it was that they aspired to this position of high priesthood, but it was called then Lishkas Parhedrin, which is a name that he said it comprised of three words. What is Parhedrin? Three words. Par, Har, Din. Par means separateness. Har means a mountain. And Din is judgment. And all of these alluded to that latter time, a time of severity and divine judgment. So we understand the chamber was paneled with wood, and there's a greater depth to understanding the durability and longevity of the priests during the time of their nobility. However, when they became corrupted, and so God responded with severity and justice, that's when the sages changed its name to Parhedrin. And we have to understand what Rabbi Levi Yitzchak meant by this, and let's dissect it. Let's break down the word Parhedrin to understand why it alludes to the severity and justice. Let's look at those three words, Par, Har, Din. Par is from the cognate pirud, separated. Severity divides and disintegrates. That's what it does. And Rabbi Levi Yitzchak explains that Par is connected to the gevuras, and that is the severity, the discipline, which unfortunately separates. Well, Har, a mountain, if you look at a mountain, we all know Table Mountain is hard. It's unmoving. It stays in its place. And then the third cognate of that word, din, is judgment. Explained Rabbi Levi Yitzchak. God's judgment was harsh and unmoving, and it resulted in the early disintegration, the early termination of the life of the high priest. And so you think of this. Would the sages have given the high priests such a negative moniker? Is it because, you know, they, because of their lifestyle, because of their corruption? What was this about? On the surface, it seems there's something about it that we don't understand. But Reb Levick's son, the Rebbe, explained and expounded on his father's teaching, and he explained and revealed a deeper meaning to what his father told us. And he found that the two names of this priestly chamber that was previously called Lishkas Ha'etz, the wooden chamber, or the tree chamber, as Rabbi Levi explained it, and its later name, Parhedrin, that the two roles that were played by every high priest. A very fascinating explanation. Wood alludes to the labor of the righteous, whereas parhedrin alludes to the labor of the Baal Teshuva, of a returnee to Judaism. And the Rebbe explained that the tree's sturdy longevity alludes to the uninterrupted progress of a tzaddik of the righteous. A tzaddik is an unblemished individual whose devotion to God is a straight line of continual ascent, a journey of constant growth and achievement. The name Lishkas Ha'etz, the wooden tree chamber, alludes to the Kohen Gadol's responsibility to advance the work of the righteous. And we know the former Kohanim Gedolim started with Aaron and Kohen were indeed tzaddikim, holy, righteous, pious people. But the name Parhedrin, that the sages changed and referred to it in later times, that alludes to the other, the more complicated role played by the Kohen Gadol. And that is not only a reference to the corruptive time they lived in, but the purpose of a Kohen Gadol is to support the journey, not only of the righteous and pious, but also of the Baal Tshuva, of the person returning, the penitent, those who stray from the proper path, and then they find a way back. They must not only return in terms of their behavior, but also reinvent their character and their persona. To move forward in a spiritual journey, a Baal Tshuva cannot self-define in terms of their previous persona. We cannot just, when you're driving, yes, you have to look back sometimes, but look at your rearview mirror. It's much smaller in comparison to the big, what do you call that window, the windscreen. You have to break with the past and become a completely new person. By disavowing a previous self and adopting a new self, a new identity to whom yesterday's actions are an anathema, are unrecognizable, a person can break with previous behavioral patterns, as detrimental as they were, and realize that there is a path ahead to return to Hashem. Realizing we're so close to Rosh Hashanah, it's only 6 weeks away. This is a very relevant and pertinent message to all of us. And I think a message that we could all adapt in our own lives. And the Rebbe wanted to explain the link between Teshuvah and Parhedrin. The high priest's support of the Baal Teshuvah's effort to make a complete change is alluded to in that name, Parhedrin. The Parhedrin officers, the tax collectors, they had no tenure. After a year, their appointment would expire. The next appointee was a completely different person. And this is like the penitent whose previous character expires. And the person who moves forward is entirely different. Of course, our past shapes our present and our future. But this is forward-looking. And this is brings us back to the three elements of the word parhedrin. Remember, it's a cognate of the words par har din. Par means separateness, har means a mountain, and din is judgment. And these refer respectively to that self-restraint, the severity, and judgment. All three of which a Baal Tshuva must employ in pursuit of repentance. The par, that separateness, that a Baal Tshuva uses the self-restraint to set distinctions between right and wrong, realizing perhaps my previous past behavior was incorrect and needs to be rectified. Har, I have to realize what is a mountain. The mountain is ironclad, it's unmovable. And therefore my resolutions must be unmoving like a mountain. And finally, din, the judgment. We judge our past behavior honestly and objectively in order to arrive at a true state of teshuva. We call it also CPR, charity, prayer, repentance. It's a matter of changing, rectifying, identifying what was wrong in my life and how I could rectify those behaviors. And so the Rebbe revealed the true depth of his father's teaching, that the two names of the chamber don't reflect a diminution of the high priest's role, but rather, on a deeper level, the high priest's dual roles. To support the long, uninterrupted journey of the righteous and to support the transformative journey of the penitent Baal Teshuva. And when I think of these two teachings, they reflect Reb Levick's view of his fellow Jews. The first teaching demonstrates his belief that anyone who follows the Torah meticulously can serve God with a complete heart. Baal, don't digress, don't deviate from the Torah's teachings, not to the right, not to the left, not to be exclusionary, not to be inclusionary, not to subtract, not to add. And therefore, we're able to serve God with a complete heart. And when did he teach this? He taught this as a parting message to his followers, to his congregants, as he was being arrested by the communist regime for his counter-revolutionary activities of teaching, of inspiring his constituents, the Jewish community in Ukraine. And his second teaching demonstrates that even the greatest sinner can have a beautiful future. That's what Rabbi Levick taught. And even though he was a sophisticated realist, he understood the realities of his day, the reality of life, but he loved all Jews, including the most ardent communists who had strayed from Judaism. He refused to see their behavior as a reflection of their inner selves. Instead, he saw their potential. And sadly, in his day, many young Jews were swept up in the idealism of the communist movement. Many served as KGB informants against their co-religionists. And in fact, there's a story told about a particular Jew, Chaim, who lived on the top floor of a Blavik's building. He served officially as the building manager, but unofficially, unfortunately, he was known to be an informant to the authorities about any illegal activity that would take place in the rabbi's home. And the story is told that one day, Chaim met Reb Levick and everything changed. It was one night in 1935 when a woman asked Reb Levick to officiate the marriage of her children who were part of the Communist Party. And Reb Levick needed a minyan, 10 men, in order to officiate this marriage according to Jewish law. And the 10th man, he called upon Chaim. Of course, Chaim was taken aback and thought, you want me, the informant? But Reb Levick didn't judge him. And he included him. And he accepted him. And later on, this man made a complete change and realized what a life he was living that was misguided, and made those changes in order to connect to his Judaism, all because Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, in his teachings and in the way he lived his life, was non-judgmental, but rather was one who was inclusionary of his fellow Jews. And that inspired this man to change his life. As we mark the Yahrzeit of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, we know that sadly, after he was arrested in 1941, he would never set foot back into Yekaterinoslav again. And with his arrest, it appeared that the communists had won, that the Nazis even further destroyed the life, what was left of Jewish life in Yekaterinoslav, that they suffered so much tremendous loss there. But yet we know that his son, the Rebbe, picked up where he had left off. And for years, the Rebbe sent secret emissaries behind the Iron Curtain to maintain regular contact with the Jewish community here. The Rebbe preserved the embers of the flames that his predecessor, the previous Rebbe, and his father had stoked. And despite the authorities' best efforts, an underground network of Jewish life had continued and thrived throughout the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union fell, the Rebbe openly sent many emissaries to be there to serve the Jewish community. And today we know how active and robust and thriving the Jewish community is, no matter how challenging the times, the situation they face is. Dnepropetrovsk today boasts a large and active Jewish community. In fact, the Menorah Center, a huge Jewish community center in the middle of Dnepropetrovsk, is the largest Jewish center in Europe. And from its viewing balcony, you can pick out the dreary building where Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson was taken prisoner. When comparing the two buildings, you can clearly see which of the two had prevailed. Reb Levi Yitzchak's community, from his shul, which had grown into this huge menorah center, is active, it's robust, it is thriving. It is a place today where you can see a flourishing Jewish community, whereas that old Soviet prison is derelict and is decrepit.